Hello everybody, welcome to Media Voices, the only media-focused news podcast in the entire world. Don't go looking for any more because there aren't any. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe, and definitely not condoning those lies.
And I'm Peter Houston. I'm a bit confused as to what just happened.
Peter, who did you talk to this week?
This week I had the immense pleasure of speaking to my dear friend Nikki Simpson. Nikki was the insufferable nag that made sure I published the magazine Diaries back in the day. She was the driving force behind Magfest and now is director of a proposed international magazine centre in Edinburgh.
But as ever, before that, we will go through our news roundup. And to begin with, okay, so a couple of weeks ago, we all took part in a panel at 2020 Publishing in London, and we asked about the future of print. And Peter, do you remember I said that print was going to be almost exclusively a marketing gimmick for new print products going forward?
Yes,
so why don't you tell us what this news story is?
Well, BuzzFeed has been handing out a marketing gimmick in New York, a print-based marketing gimmick. They printed a newspaper, which they've been handing out in New York. I don't know. I mean, I've seen loads and loads of tweets about it, and people love it. But, you know, interestingly, it's all people that work in other digital media companies that love it. There's that sort of ever-so-ironic thing going on
about
it.
They just go, God, we, you know what, thinking about it, we do want to be in print.
In case you were wondering, yes, they have done a GIF in print form.
Yeah, that was...
It's not even good, though. It's pretty lame. I'm sure there's better ways. If, you know, if they had a brain about them, they could have done a kind of flip book thing that would have been a real GIF in print.
That is such a better idea.
Yeah, there you go. And, you know, the world can have that for free because that's the kind of guy I am.
Esther, if you can come up with a good reason for why they did this, I'd love to hear it.
I have absolutely... I mean, to be fair, I got people talking.
Yeah, they and did. It was exactly that. It was a marketing gimmick.
I did love the tagline that fans all across New York will be able to check out the must-read stories without ever needing Wi-Fi. That's literally what a mobile... phone.
Well, it's not even that. Have either of you been to New York in the last couple of years?
I've never been.
Oh, you've got to go. Wi-Fi is everywhere. It is. They have those, you know, those hotspots on every street corner. You are never going to be without Wi-Fi if you have a modern mobile phone.
There you go then. But of course, print is actually the first truly mobile device.
How far back can we go with that, though? Is it like the larynx actually turns out to be the first mobile form of communication?
Or even smoke signals? Well, that's maybe not so mobile. I don't know. I mean, the whole thing is a total stunt. They said it was a stunt. They said they did it for fun. It was a one-time stunt.
The only thing I'd say is when I read the headline at first, I was like, oh, that's quite cool. BuzzFeed News are doing like a newspaper. Mm. And then it turned out like it wasn't that at all. Now that would be a cool marketing stunt for BuzzFeed News, is to be like, oh, we're actually just as cool as all the other print newspapers. You know, we're just as credible. Here's a newspaper.
Yeah, but which staff are putting that together at BuzzFeed News?
I do wonder.
Oh.
I do wonder if people in real newspapers got a bit arsey about this, because it's like, well, you're just taking the piss here.
Do you think they were, or do you think they were flattered? Imitation is the sincerest form of... Wait, is that the phrase? You know what, though? I did see so many people in my Twitter feed asking their friends in New York to grab them a copy. Now, to be fair, my newsfeed is almost exclusively journalists.
But you know what? That's the collectability of print.
Well, that's absolutely true. You're right.
Even for marketing gimmicks.
Who would want that Momo face sitting in their living room?
Yeah,
that's
that one's
kind
bizarre.
Of creepy, yeah.
Oh, speaking of creepy, Facebook is pivoting to privacy. Or is it? Esther, this is your beat. What is happening here?
Yeah, it's another week, it's another Facebook story. Zuck has posted a 3,000-word essay to Facebook explaining why he was wrong to build a company predicated on the assumption that we would want to share everything publicly. And there's nothing wrong with his actual thoughts on this, for once. But I think the problem a lot of people have identified is that this is not going to translate into actual action. The only thing he's promised is the unification of Instagram, DMs, Messenger and WhatsApp, which, and we knew about that a few weeks ago. And that, if you're being cynical / realistic...
Accurate, yeah.
...is just a move to make it harder to break Facebook up. He's promised privacy-related stuff before. We were supposed to have a big clear history feature that was promised a couple of years ago. Well, that's not materialised yet. And there's quite a good Guardian piece that pointed out that actually Facebook's stock didn't change at all. So if the investors are kind of worried that Facebook's going to, you know, pivot to privacy, restrict its monetization models a bit, well, that's... I don't think they're actually worried about that.
This whole thing's just nuts. I mean, there was two really strong opinions that came through, that I saw. One is that the Zuck got religion. He's going to sacrifice Facebook's newsfeed revenues on the altar of all that's right and decent.
Like I said, stock disagrees.
Yeah. The other one was, which is probably what's driving the stock price, that the Zuck's full of shit and nothing will ever change. But I think Ben Thompson, as always, is spot on in this one. He's got the view that it's not a dramatic pivot. It's actually a growth opportunity for Facebook, because what they're trying to do, as they did with Snapchat in the past with stories, is kind of co-opt the competitive advantage of another platform, which is that one-to-one aspect, because he believes, and we've talked about this before, that messaging is the way it's all going to go.
Mm-hmm. In The Guardian, there's a new article, and it's entitled, Facebook's new move isn't about privacy, it's about domination. And in which
that's Ben Thompson's point.
But in the Guardian piece, the author is explicitly saying that privacy plays better when stacked up against WeChat, which is the biggest social network in China.
But that's bullshit, because Facebook's not in China.
Well, exactly.
Facebook's banned in China.
It's not there yet. But what if
this move to privacy will make it even more difficult for them to get into China?
Yeah, the Guardian's missed a mark on that one.
All right, so hang on. Let me read from the conclusion. Tencent, the company that offers WeChat, is very close to the government of the People's Republic of China, and WeChat users assume that communication is subject to state surveillance.
No, I don't. I think the thing, a lot of what Zuckerberg's moving towards is the WhatsApp-like encryption on everything.
Yeah, he's talking about end-to-end encryption, and if you actually promise end-to-end encryption and deliver end-to-end encryption, then the government can't eavesdrop.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how snug he gets to the Chinese government, that you cannot physically unbreak that.
No, that's true.
And it's one of the things that is surprising about if they're going to move all the ad, like if they want to develop the ad products on that, is that you can't target keywords and things if they're encrypted.
Which is why everyone went, oh, Zuck's sacrificing newsfeed revenue. But actually what he said was that, you know, he beat this metaphor to death on the living room in the public square. So he actually wants to have his cake and eat it. We're still going to have newsfeed, that's a public square, but we're also going to have the living room where we can all talk to each other.
But is there then, and I'm just going to throw this one out, is there any evidence that maybe Facebook is being a bit hypocritical about this? Just throwing it out there. So have they, for instance, been doing massive amounts of lobbying against privacy laws?
Oh, that's a segue. This is one of those stories that if it had got out and Facebook hadn't done anything else, it would have caused like worldwide shock. But as it is, it's just every single week it's a new thing. So this has been like, okay, yeah, Facebook have been pressuring politicians with investments and incentives.
I really do admire Facebook, and to some extent the Trump administration's approach to making headlines, which is, you know, you just make enough noise that nobody can concentrate on any one crisis for long enough.
But actually, what's come out about this is actually awful what they've been doing. I know George Osborne was one of the politicians that they've been targeting with incentives, and they've kind of been like pressuring them to lobby on Facebook's behalf. And like, this has all come out of their internal documents.
What do you mean incentives? Whoa. What's the incentives then?
So Facebook were threatening to withhold investment from countries unless they supported or passed Facebook-friendly laws, according to The Guardian.
Here's something. I can't remember exactly where I saw this, but it was kind of a sobering realization, was that for all we talk about things like, why don't you just quit Facebook? Why don't you just, you know, why don't we just force Facebook to abide by these laws? For a lot of people in certain countries and certain territories, Facebook, for all intents and purposes, is the internet. And it is the means by which they communicate, and it is the means by which they do a lot of their most vital forms of communication. So, I mean, in one sense, it kind of backs up this idea that Facebook does need increased scrutiny. But how do you dismantle that without also basically ripping up a lot of people's access to the internet?
We could talk about this forever, and I don't want to.
Moving on then, there's lots of news about Bauer this week, as they have acquired the UKRD Group, and they've launched two new titles. So for those who don't know, the UKRD Group owns 10 regional radio stations across England with 722,000 weekly listeners, which is, you know, a hell of an audience to buy. Radio listeners tend to be more engaged, and Bauer already has quite a few, you know, investments in this area, so that is some good synergy there.
Sorry, we're not allowed to use the word synergy in a non-ironic sense.
It's only because I saw the Financial Times had acquired the Next Web, and they used synergy about 8 times in the press release, and it's just been on my mind since then. But the news out of Bauer this week that got us really riled up is that they've launched Well, what have they launched there? There's a new crime title on the market. Esther, what is this crime title?
I have to say, first off, they have actually launched another magazine that's slightly less offensive this week. Take a Break, Mate. And the other is they've launched Crime Monthly. So they've identified there's obviously a bit of a trend for people listening to true crime podcasts and true crime documentaries. So they said, okay, let's launch a magazine. That in itself is fine. Good business case. You identify a trend, you launch a magazine. If I tell you that it's put together by the team that do Heat, I think that tells you absolutely everything you need to know about the cover and style. I saw the cover on Twitter, and I had kind of had to do a double take. I was like, have they seriously put this out? Yeah. They've got murdered schoolgirl Millie Dowler as the cover star.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? She's the star in the same way that you might have Kerry Katona or a Gemma from TOWIE, kind of on this white background, smiling as though she's promoting some sort of product or her new diaries or something.
And yeah, the headline is Millie, New Agony, Full Shocking Story Inside. It's just disgusting. And
That's true crime, though. That's what true crime is all about now.
Is it? I know that's always been the case, you know, that you have the kind of National Enquirer titles, you know, where they go, you know, oh, my husband was impregnated by a ghost, all that kind of like trash. And true crime definitely used to be that. But now I feel like it's been elevated through...
By what?
What?
Who elevated
Well, through the efforts of some very high quality, you know, editorial efforts like Serial, like a bunch of the ones that you get, the newly commissioned ones that you get on Netflix. And now true crime has this kind of professional veneer to it that isn't just kind of sneering, lurid details.
Well, I think you're self-selecting there, mate. If you look at the many thousands of true crime podcasts, which is really what's driving us, right? If you look at the many thousands of true crime podcasts and look at the classy ones versus the absolutely not classy ones, that's going to be way stacked in favour of absolutely not classy.
You know what's an interesting counterpoint to this?
It's just that kind of
genre. It is, and people have always, you know, like to rubber neck. People always like to gawp over the latest lore of details and everything. That's why you do get some podcasts that do things like recreations and they hire actors to make it more dramatic. And you know why you get people like My Favourite Murder, who take this kind of like slightly poorly researched, deliberately poorly researched look into their favourite murder from that week. But this one just feels so much more crass than any of the others.
I quite like the description of one Twitter user who just said it's crime porn. Actually, that's exactly what it is. You know, it's not you know, your tasteful photo shoots, and it is just so lurid. Honestly, if that's what the cover is, I dread to think what the inside is. I mean, there's another Twitter user that said anybody who was caught with buying that should have their hands cut off.
That
makes sense, because then they can cover that in the next monthly edition.
I think you're both being a little bit.
It would be precious.
Naive here, yeah. That is what true crime's about, guys. And all they've done, you know, you rightly made the point that it's launched by the people that launched Heat. It's just, instead of stars with cellulite, it's serial killers and
it's
people
murdered schoolgirls.
But I know somebody's popped in the notes that about Grey Cinema's Foul Play magazine. I had a flick through that at the Magfest back in September, and you know, that's not gratuitous. It's a much more kind of sensitive look, and you're looking in depth at this stuff, but it's not like shocking story, like all the agony of the family, like that kind of thing. It's a much classier look. This is, if you're one of the families of Millie Dowler, and you see that on the cover, I mean, it's just so insensitive.
Yeah.
And absolutely. I think that there is a way to do it that takes a high road but can still be entertaining.
But, you know, what got Grace and Emma to do what they're doing with Foul Play is exactly that. They didn't want to be doing true crime stuff in the sense of, you know, gratuitous whatever. They wanted it to be classy, and they didn't want... The interview that we did with Grace, she talks about not having pictures of crime scenes deliberately. So, yeah, there's a different way of doing it, but, you know, Grace and Emma's going to make a lot less money than Bauer's going to make
with
true crime.
Is this a...
It'll have an incredible shelf life, but I think they'll ride the true crime wave for a couple of years.
Yeah, in that sense,
maybe
that's all it needs to do. It just needs to be a source of revenue. Moving on to slightly more wholesome news, the Financial Times has ranked Readly as one of Europe's fastest growing companies.
Well, Readly actually is a Netflix for magazines. I'm sorry for digging that up, because we've had Spotify for this and Netflix for that, but But Readly actually is a Netflix for magazines. It's got 3,900, almost 4,000 national and international magazines in the app. It has a Netflix price of £7.99 a month. The revenue growth last year was 723%.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. I mean, that's pretty good.
I mean, they had a massive marketing campaign, didn't they?
Was it January
last year?
They were on a TV. Yeah.
Is it still the PDF copies of magazines?
Well, this is, you know, it's not. It flows much more straightforward. But yeah, it is taking your standard PDF workflow and putting it on. And, you know, I'll hold my hand up. I said a long time ago that that Readly wouldn't do particularly well. It shows what I know. You know, at the height of the iPad boom, Readly were doing, like Esther was saying, straight PDF replicas, and anyone who was kind of excited about iPad magazines at that point said, Readly's going nowhere with this, and, you know, they're doing
so
great.
What we need to do then is talk to them and find out how much publishers are making from that.
But we know that, though, don't we? It's a Netflix or Spotify for magazines.
But they have hit some pretty good growth and milestones in the past year. So they launched in the Netherlands in November last year. A Readly exclusive, a new exclusive content feature was launched back in September. They got about 10 million euros investment in August. And, you know, today they're saying that they're providing local content from 7 key markets. So it is far beyond the proposition that they initially mooted here.
The growth that they're talking about is similar to what Deliveroo is having.
So that's just very good news for Readly, isn't it? But does it mean that there's nobody else who can occupy that space now? Is Readly almost the Netflix in terms of the people breaking in?
Well, doesn't this depend? I mean, Esther's worked a lot in this area, but doesn't this depend on what Apple does with texture?
It entirely depends. I think I would be quite nervous about this.
Also, you know what they haven't released in this press release is user numbers. So I would be very interested to see exactly how user numbers have grown and changed, and whether, you know, people are holding off in favour of these new products that might be coming down the pipe. And the news in brief.
LinkedIn is apparently launching a weekly podcast looking at the role work plays in people's lives. Just what we all need, actually. I wish they would just sort the groups function out and stop messing around.
And as mentioned before, the Financial Times has acquired a controlling stake in The Next Web, an Amsterdam-based tech and media outlet. The press release used the word synergy as early as the third paragraph, but this really does seem to be a smart move. The FT wants to get more into live events, and The Next Web has that infrastructure.
The Philadelphia Inquirer is launching a new Sunday print section that focuses on good news.
I sat next to Sean Degenwood of Positive News, who we've had on this podcast, and the students who were in the audience were genuinely very interested in this idea of good news. So this to me seems like it might be an experiment worth repeating, even though historically papers that exclusively focus on that haven't done very well.
Civil has launched its cryptocurrency token following a failed fundraiser last year. Yet another sentence that I really don't know what
well,
it means.
Well, it failed because there were too many steps, but I think... Yeah.
I remember this.
I think they've got it down to 31
steps. It's down to like 31
now,
isn't it?
So therefore, very easy for everybody to purchase this cryptocurrency. And finally, YouTube will start showing information panels when people search for topics that are, quote, prone to misinformation.
Will this make the blindest bit of
difference?
Possibly.
I think the best thing to do would be to delist that kind of stuff. You know, that's a huge debate. We're talking about everything from, you know, right to free speech versus right to having a platform. But for the most part, this just seems to be an attempt to actually curb some of the rampant misinformation that is on YouTube.
This week, I'm speaking with Nikki Simpson, formerly business manager for the PPA in Scotland. We spoke mostly about Nikki's latest project, the International Magazine Centre in Edinburgh. But before we got onto that, I asked Nikki just how she became such a massive magazine geek.
Got a job at White Light Media, which is a content marketing company based in Edinburgh in Leith, where I worked for my favourite boss ever. Apologies to all my other bosses. But Fraser Allen, who runs White Light Media and is an all-round awesome guy. So there I fell in love with print and with design. It was the first time I was really kind of aware of the time and love and effort and passion that goes into magazine publishing. I think I can probably blame that on one of my colleagues there, Adam Wilson, and on another colleague, Eric Campbell, both of whom are shit-hot designers and just really showed me what, you know, the difference between crap design and great design and what it can do for a publication and how it can lead the eye, and not necessarily how great design is always, you know, all singing, all dancing, you know, make it pop kind of design, but it just can be design that actually just takes you through a magazine in the way that you want it to. So that's where I fell in love with magazines. And then while I was working with there, I had a frank conversation with Fraser about, because he was my friend by that point, of course, about my salary expectations for the future. And we decided that unless the company was to expand into a second office or whatever, that there wasn't really anywhere for me to go because I was the business manager there and there was only one role there. And then the job came up at PPA, which is the Trade Association for Magazine Publishers in the UK, in case anybody's listened to this abroad.
Loads of people listen to this abroad.
Oh, well, okay. So for everyone listening to this abroad, then. So the job came up at PPA for the business manager in Scotland. And Fraser actually talked to me about it. He's like, Nikki, I don't want you to leave, but I really think this would be a great opportunity for you. So, you know, why don't you go for it? And he was actually on the executive committee at that point. So that was quite amusing, having my boss interview me for the position for the next role, which was quite weird. No room for embellishment or anything.
Yeah, that's pretty
weird. Yeah, it was. You know, they were asking me questions and I was going, I don't know, Fraser, what do you think? But got the job and worked there for about 5 years. And again, that just made me love the industry even more, and just put me in touch with so many incredible, passionate, talented people working in the industry who are, they just love magazines as much as I do and have become my friends, I guess. And now all I want to do is just support them. So then I left PPA. When I had a baby, his name's Horace. If you want to see a cute pic, I will send Peter one and he can put it on the Media Voices website. So then came back to PPA and wanted to just work 2 days a week, but we decided that actually it wasn't going to be appropriate. It wasn't going to be fair on the members, really, because it's a one-man band in Scotland. While working at PPA, had this idea to set up an international magazine centre. And at the end of the day, when I was coming back to PPA, I was just thinking, do you know what, that's what I really want to focus on. So it was a kind of blessing in that respect. And the girl that's taken over from me at PPA is just totally phenomenal at her job. So, yay.
Before you move on to talk about the international magazine centre, you missed a very important part of the puzzle. You didn't talk about MagFest, which you started.
Yeah, well, no, I didn't actually start it. It was actually my predecessor, Kathy Crawford Hay, who she actually did it for a year when I think it was like my third week or something on the job at the first MagFest. So she started it, brought over some incredible speakers from America and stuff. Brilliant event. And then so in my first year, we just did a small event so I could get my kind of feet under the table, so I knew what I was doing. There was only like 60 people there. And then the following year we built it and built it again and built it again. And yeah, it did become my baby after a while. So that was the one thing that was really difficult to let go of when I left PPA. It was because I just love organising events, just to be that kind of contact point for so many people and to be creating something that can actually have so much influence on people without you even knowing it. You know, there's so many conversations I have now where people are like, oh yeah, I met them at MagFest, that's how I've got that job now. Or somebody even left some feedback, I remember, after we had Wyatt Mitchell over from The New Yorker. They said that they were so moved by his talk that they completely reconsidered their career as a creative director. And I just thought, wow, this is actually having a real impact on people. It's not just like people going, oh, yeah, I'm going to a conference and we're going to sit in a box for a whole day and feel a bit sleepy and, you know, have some crap sausage rolls. Somebody always complained about the sausage rolls.
For anyone who's never been lucky enough to be to MagFest, what's the elevator pitch?
So to me, from my elevator pitch, because to me it's a project that I'm still so passionate about, even though I haven't actually curated one in a couple of years. To me, it's just like inviting all my magazine heroes to come and speak to all my magazine friends. And that is just, I mean, what more fun can you have than that, yeah, you know?
With your clothes on.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just so much fun, you know? It's just, I think, I don't know about other communities across the world, but I know what the kind of London vibe is like sometimes. Sometimes it's not, sometimes it's lovely, and it depends where you go, I think. But sometimes it can be so focused on business and making money that people forget about the passion in the industry. And I think in London, fair enough, I mean, you know, with the house prices there alone, you know, you're not going to be able to focus on anything else but making money. But I just feel like in Scotland, it's all about the passion, and it's all about connecting people, and it's all about just really celebrating the joy of magazine publishing. And I think, everything that Magfest is kind of reflects that, you know. We just got such a great buzz about the place, you know.
So that brings us perfectly to your plans for the International Magazine Centre in Edinburgh. What's all that about?
So, what's all that about? So the second year I was running Magfest, we sold out on tickets, so we had a great year. It was only 200 people, but at the time that felt massive. And it was also at the same time as the Scottish independence referendum. So I was down in London actually on the day of the Scottish independence referendum, which was really weird. There was like thunder, lightning and stuff down there. So we were all like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Everybody was interested in what was happening around Scotland, and everybody was interested in what was happening around Magfest and what was happening in magazines. And they'd heard about this great event and so on. So I just kind of really wanted to perpetuate that feeling of things happening, and that's connectivity, really. And I think because of the independence referendum, you know, there's this constant thought about how we were potentially going to get cut off from the rest of the UK and what that could mean for our relationship with Europe. And then subsequently, with Brexit coming in and so on, there's just this constant thought of, you know, we're cutting off to so many people. This is something that, you know, a couple of people said to me, well, is this a good time to do this around Brexit? And I'm like, well, yeah, it's the best time to do it, because this is all about connecting with people. It's about showing people that we're not interested in cutting off. We just really want to kind of just say we're welcoming, we're friendly. We really want to actually reach out to the rest of the world, not just, you know, sit in our own little silos.
I mean, I guess that's why it's called the International Magazine Centre and not the Scottish Magazine Centre.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think there's some brilliant things going on in Scotland and across the UK. But to me, it's about, you know, I mean, what's the point in the internet if we can't actually connect internationally and learn from other countries? You know, I mean, it's just, we've got this fantastic gift that people are often complaining about because of the supposed death of print and all this shite. And you just think, well, do you know what? Actually, this is just this amazing opportunity for thousands of publishers, not only to connect with each other, but to distribute internationally, to, you know, to do, you name it, you've got it. It's on a plate.
So how's that going to work? What's it going to look like? What do you hope to do?
The dream, basically, I suppose the dream is the wrong word. The plan is to create a physical building that would be basically come and worship at the altar of magazine publishing. So
whoa, that's a bit deep.
I know, get excited. So an office space for publishers and affiliated industries. So anybody connected with the magazine publishing industry, advertisers, journalists, designers, photographers, illustrators, people working in data, developers, marketing, events, so anybody that could loosely be affiliated with magazine publishing. So what we'd love is like a core basis of, say, maybe 4 or 5 anchor tenants, but then alongside that have loads of freelancers, have an incubator space for new publishers and graduates coming in from the industry, have hot desking space, have meeting rooms dedicated to these people. And a dedicated space as well for international publishers who are thinking about coming to the UK to either set up their business here, or they're just passing through the UK and want a kind of somewhere where they can actually feel there's a home for them. So that's the office space. The world's best magazine shop, I think, is the only way I really want to describe it. I really feel that's quite ambitious, and I'm sorry if there's proprietors of magazine shops across the world going, oh, you're not going to get better than mine, but my hope is that I really will get better than yours. And what that's going to look like is every kind of magazine imaginable that you can think of. So not just consumer magazines, not just business to business magazines, but membership magazines, niche magazines, magazines you never heard of, international magazines, multilingual magazines, internal magazines, magazines from just zines as well, like every kind of magazine that you can possibly imagine. And this is not just for publishers, obviously. The half of the point of the International Magazine Centre is to really connect with consumers, because PPA and other trade associations are fantastic at connecting with publishers and, you know, learning from each other and getting all that information out there. But we're not doing as much as we could to be able to connect with consumers. And at the end of the day, one of the main reasons that I think that the magazine sales are falling in general is because people are obviously moving online. They're kind of moving away from things. And I speak to consumers, friends, obviously, and say, you know, what kind of magazines do you read? And they go, oh, I don't really read magazines anymore. And the reason for that is because they're not going into a shop and going, wow, look at these like 50,000 magazines. They're going into a newsagent and seeing like the same 10 magazines on sale in every single shop. And there's nothing against those 10 magazines, and the reasons those 10 magazines are there is because they're selling well, so I get that. But to me, you really need to be actually going out to people and saying, look at these magazines that are made for you personally. Because once you've found that magazine that's made for you, you feel like the editor is actually writing to you. You feel like when you read that magazine that it's been created for you personally. And that's the most wonderful feeling. And you can't pull yourself away from that magazine. And that's when you start subscribing to something, because you just think, this isn't just something I should read or something that my pals are reading or whatever. This is something that actually really speaks to me as a human being, you know?
So where you are in your planning?
Hold on a minute, sir. You are jumping way ahead. I have loads more. We've got a shop, we've got offices, we've got an event space as well. And then on top of that as well, we're talking to Napier University and National Library of Scotland about research projects we could do. So how the magazine has reflected and affected the body image throughout the decades, for example. You know, these are like really, to me, really fascinating subjects that I think society could really learn from, and magazine publishers could learn from. You know?
So where are you planning?
So where am I at with my planning? So we have just launched the website. I guess that's why we're talking to each other right now. So that's super exciting. Feels like we've been sitting on that for a long time. So to actually get it out there is really exciting. So one of the things we want to do is we want to set up a monthly event in conjunction with Edinburgh Napier University, where we'll invite international publishers to speak over Skype to an audience in Scotland. And then we'll record those talks and we'll curate the best content from those talks to create a training course for publishers. As well as that, we have set up a licensing hub as part of the International Magazine Centre website. So giving magazine publishers the opportunity to get their content out there on a platform which international publishers can come and look at and see what's available. And that's obviously not just for the UK, that's for any international publisher. One of the things I'm really, really conscious of is that, of course, coming to the International Magazine Centre, if you're in Scotland, is going to be top of your list of things to do. But for anybody living in Japan, America, whatever, this isn't going to be, you know, hugely beneficial to them if in a physical space. So what we're trying to do is translate everything that we could do from a physical space onto a digital space. So the talks, for example, will be available online afterwards. The research that we do will be available online. The exhibitions that we do will have they'll have them online as well. The kind of support that we're offering in our incubator space will have resources online for that as well. I keep thinking about what could actually be super beneficial to people, and visas keeps on coming to the forefront of my mind, which is possibly the most dull and depressing kind of route to go down, but I suspect at some point we might try to start offering advice on that. And then, of course, we need to find a venue. One of the things that we're doing in the meantime before we find a venue is we're trying to plan pop-up international magazine centres at places of cultural interest across the world. So the equivalent of the V&A, for example, in Amsterdam, Paris, you name it. Sorry, that's just Europe. I mean, obviously, I would be keen to go elsewhere as well. But just kind of trying to make connections with people so that if we were to run a pop-up International Magazine Centre, say over the course of a week or 2 weeks in their country, that we could run workshops, we could do publisher events, we could do talks, we could have a little shop, we could have exhibition and so on. So again, the kind of embodiment of what will be the all singing, all dancing building eventually, brought into somebody else's country, which I think even if it doesn't actually gain that much traction. I kind of feel like that's something that we should do just to actually just connect with people, you know, just to go, this isn't just about what's happening in Scotland. This is about, you know, what you could be a part of on a bigger basis. And of course, we're applying for funding. This is a not-for-profit venture, so, we need to find some money.
Who in the industry is supporting you?
So we've got support from lots of Scottish publishers, from Edinburgh Napier University. That's one of our key partners. From various other magazine-y people, from PPA, from FIP, who are the International Trade Association for Magazine Publishers and Media. Sorry, James, I'm sure you wouldn't like me to call it magazine. It's magazine media. From the Global Editors Network, from people like My Culture and Stack magazines, and from lots of different trade associations as well, who are again in affiliated industries. So we've got support from the Institute of Practitioners in Advertising, the Marketing Society, people like this. So it's kind of all coming together, and I suppose I'm just kind of, this is this first step, really, just chatting to you and talking about what kind of way we want to take it forward.
People that are listening, how can they get involved?
So you can have a look at our website. There's a support page. You can become a patron of the International Magazine Centre. You can donate anything between $1 and as much as you like, enough to pay my rent if you wish. Those aren't the only two options, obviously. But yeah, you can become a patron, and that would be an amazing way to support us. But there's so many other ways as well. So you can help us spread the word. You can follow us on Twitter. You can retweet us. Any kind of connections you've got. So if you want to introduce us to somebody, we'd love to meet anybody you'd like to introduce us to on an international basis. Any way we can spread the word is awesome. You can sign up for a newsletter, you can offer us a space, you can recommend content for the website. So we set up an inspiration page for not only for amazing things that are happening in publishing, but also amazing articles from publishers. So again, this has a consumer-facing side to it, and we really want to get this out to consumers to go, look at all these fantastic articles that are out there. You know, look at what you're missing out on just by not reading. You know, what else can you do? Jeepers, there's a list as long as my arm. You can help us with pop-up shops. You can recommend somebody to come and speak, or you can volunteer to speak yourself. That's probably enough to be getting on with. Have a look at the website.
Is the website really the focus for what you've got going on at the moment?
It is, yeah. I think, as I say, we just launched it the other day, so that's been our main focus up until now.
Now, we always ask our guests on the podcast, as you know.
I know.
What's your favourite piece of media recently? It's got to be a magazine, hasn't it? After all of that, it's got to be a magazine.
It's actually not. It's a book. So the thing that I was reading about recently was an article in The Guardian from a woman called Caroline Criado Perez, who has been researching for the past 3 years on the way that the world that we live in is built on male data. The deadly truth about a world built for men, from stab vests to car crashes. And the thing that was really frightening, I was genuinely scared to actually get in a car after this. So men are more likely than women to be involved in a car crash, which means they dominate the numbers of those seriously injured in them. But when a woman is involved in a car crash, she's 47% more likely to be seriously injured and 71% more likely to be moderately injured, even when researchers control for factors such as height, weight, seatbelt usage and crash intensity. She's also 17% more likely to die, and it's all because of the way the car is designed. And that's because they're using men as a crash test dummy, basically. So they're built differently. They have different shape of vertebrae, they have different, the way that their hips sit, they have different ways that their skin is thicker. I didn't know that. So that when they're you're far more likely to get whiplash as a woman. Don't be laughing at this, Peter. This is skinny shit.
We're making me feel guilty for being a man.
It's not your fault. I'm just saying. And then they were talking about how years and years ago somebody said, well, maybe we should have a female crash test dummy as well. And everybody went, yes, okay, we'll put her in the passenger seat, will we? And that's what they did. I know, isn't that crazy? So that's one example of a whole load of other ways in which data has been built up, you know, endlessly about how things are affecting men, but not when it comes to women. So it's just really frightening. It just made me think.
So in case any words or phrases in our interviews pass you by, we do actually have a transcript of all our interviews now. So you can either go to the website at voices.media, and we've got a little link to our transcripts in the sidebar, or we've actually got an exclusive newsletter you can sign up to get the transcript as soon as it goes live. And that's thanks to our partnership with Trint, who've got a really cool AI automated transcription tool.
And if you want to keep up with us in more or less real time, then follow along on Twitter at Media Voices Pod.
But until next week, when we are going to be back with another absolutely incredible guest, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Ta-ta.